Hi, this is Mark Bittman. Welcome to Food. As always, you can reach us at food@markbittman.com. We've heard from quite a few of you lately, and we're happy about that. Also, visit us at markbittman.com or bittmanproject.com. That's the Bittman Project, our now 3 times weekly newsletter, mostly. Check it out. Subscribe if you can. Please subscribe to the podcast. Rate it. Say nice things about it, etc., wherever you get your podcasts. Well, before we get started, I do want to mention that we have an interactive course called How to Eat Less Meat that you should check out if you want to eat less meat. It's filled with great advice, easy recipes. It's not no meat, it's less meat, so have no fear. The link is in today's show notes, and there's a discount right now for 25% off. And to get that 25% off, use the code NEWYEAR at checkout. That's How to Eat Less Meat by me.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. When I started out in the food world, let's say 1980, it was much more homogeneous. I mean, not obviously not the world of cooking, but the world of cookbook writing, the world of known chefs and so on was, I wouldn't say mostly men. I would say that aspect wasn't dominated so much by men, but it was dominated by white people, and it was dominated by mostly French or French American or sort of this weird continental kind of cooking. If you were to do a Japanese or a Iranian or a Chilean recipe, you were out there. You were doing something different. That's changed, obviously. Much has changed since then, but that's changed a great deal, although many things have not. So that's a conversation. And we had that conversation sort of with Jacques Pepin a few months back, and we'll continue to have talks about this subject, how things have changed, how they're different and not different now, and where they're going. One thing I can say with certainty, though, is that today's food world is much more heterogeneous and much more interesting than it was 40 years ago. And the new generation of food writers boasts some of the brightest, most thoughtful and interested recipe developers, writers, food people in general that we've seen in a long time. Today's guest is one of those people. His name is Eric Kim, and he is a New York Times staff writer and essayist and the recent author of the cookbook, Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. It was an instant Times bestseller, and a big part of what makes Eric's book stand out is his special relationship with his mom, Jean, which we talk about some in the show. Eric grew up in Atlanta. He was the son of Jean and Key, Korean immigrants. He wrote the book with Jean, as I said, and in one interview, Eric said, "If people think about what Korean American means, I see a graphic where Korean is the Jean part and American is the Eric part." This is an interesting story about becoming American, living in America, the kind of thing many of our families have gone through, but in a newer 21st century way. The book is full of family stories that are funny and poignant, and it's a new and kind of different kind of cookbook that we've seen more of lately. The recipes are really fun, developed with a lot of care, and super delicious. They're not stereotypical in any way. They're creative and interesting. They're, let's say, this is a phrase you're going to hear me use more than once, I think. They're authentic without being traditional, or they're authentic in a traditional way, but they're not strictly traditional. Kate fell in love with the book first, and so we reached out to Eric to come on the show. I started cooking from it. We've really had fun with it, and the interview's terrific. I hope that Eric had as much fun with it as we did. He's an ambitious, kind, wonderful, lovely guy. And for the record, I was nowhere near as smart as he is when I was starting out. Haha. So here we go.
I just have to gush for a second because your book, Korean American, came out this year and it's got a very prominent spot on my shelf. And I'm pretty picky about cookbooks because there's a lot of them.
You grew up with them.
And I love your book so much. But to say all the things that I love about it would take too long.
Thank you so much. I feel like I went through so many new experiences this year that it's like overwhelming for anyone. And I'm now like processing it. And because it's finally the end of the year and I get to like sort of slow down. And so that feels really good. Thank you for those words.
When we started writing about food, me and my friends, there was this stuff called immigrant cuisine. I'm using air quotes. And I mean, of course there still is. But what's funny is that immigrant cuisine was my grandparents' cuisine when my grandparents, because they were immigrants. And then my parents were like, again, air quotes, American. And so I grew up eating American food and thought, well, immigrant cuisine, that's like Persian and Japanese and Korean and like that. And now there's this whole sort of like, fuck you, I'm an American. I mean, I'm a Korean American, I'm an American. Kind of genre of like, I grew up here. So this is not like, I'm not pretending that I went and lived in Korea for 2 years and did all the regional stuff and da-da-da. This is our food.
I feel like Korean American was my attempt to define that. And I like fumble through it and eventually arrive at something. But I think also, this is how I see it. I don't know if it's entirely true. There were certainly Korean Americans before me, but I sort of saw this like onslaught of like new cookbooks in that way. The explanation for it is, I don't know, maybe that the children of those immigrants just finally grew up this generation, so, and became writers. And so like, it's sort of like we're like maybe like waiting for those people to just, I don't know, become old enough to write a book. And so there is this like specific generation of kids who are writing the books, and that feels really nice. I certainly don't feel alone, you know, in this endeavor. And I don't know. I was really inspired by my current colleague, Priya Krishna. She put out Indian-ish, and I remember reading it and feeling so inspired and liberated. And another thing is, all of us have gone through the same thing, which is the negative part, which is a little bit of criticism from our own communities. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I just like didn't know that that would happen. And when it first happened to me, it was after my very first Times piece. And I called her, and Priya and I were like barely friends then, but we were like acquaintances. And she said, "Welcome to the club." And then it started a chain reaction of tweets. Nick Sharma posted something about that. Sameen Nosrat did as well. I don't know. We've all been through it. And it's just nice to know that we're all like, we all share in that experience, the beauty of it, but also the hardships.
Right. You're not authentic enough.
Right. I think that's the main criticism of the book, actually, or at least the negative Amazon reviews. They always say the same thing. They're like, kimchi sandwiches with the crust cut off. I was expecting more authentic Korean food. I was like, oh man, it's like, whatever. Anyway.
There is a part in the book that you talk about the myth of authenticity. And I totally know what you mean. But I just, it's like, who do the people who are making these criticisms, what makes them more qualified than anyone else? I guess I just don't really understand who the, like, the holy priestess of authenticity is.
And I've had a whole year to think about this. And I really have psychologized that reader, which is something I like to do with human beings, so I can like understand them. But I view it as this scarcity mindset. And I really like understand where they come from. It's, imagine growing up your whole life and not seeing yourself on the page or the screen. And then finally, something does come across the page, and it's not what you think represents you and your cuisine or your family, and your mom doesn't do it like that. And there is a feeling of like protection, safeguarding a little bit, and gatekeeping. Yeah, right now my gochujang caramel cookies are kind of like on the internet. And, you know, I've seen one or two comments from people who are like, oh, great. Now people are going to find out, like, learn about gochujang. And I'm like, I think that's a good thing. I mean, especially if the money goes into the pockets of Koreans who are selling this gochujang. And anyway, it's an interesting thing. And I really think you're on either on one side or the other. And I think the book helped me realize that I'm on the side of authenticity is a sham.
Well, or there's many different authentics.
Yeah.
It's not just one authentic.
Yeah. My colleague Yolande Kamalefe said it very elegantly in her video for Jollof Rice, wonderful video on NYT cooking. She kind of said, you have to add to someone, you have to add an object, like authentic to whom? Authentic to me, authentic to a Korean American, authentic to a fourth generation Hawaiian Korean lady I met the other month, and which sparked this whole column about inheriting foods that you're kind of like distant from, you know. It's interesting. And also the joy of like cooking that food so that you can feel close again. I think that's really beautiful.
You wrote the book with your mom, who's Jean, who sounds amazing. I'm curious, and I didn't even think about this, but what does your mom think about all the authenticity, and what does the older generation think about it?
I think for the most part, they're more accepting than people realize. Like, I mean, my mom's an exception in her own way, but she throughout the book was sort of a nice North Star. She was like, Eric, like, I'm telling you, it's okay. I think it's fine. She was like, stop worrying about those critics. And I really was paralyzed by these critics early on in the book process, to the point where my second story for the Times, it was a Korean piece, and I got shingles. I always like to tell that story because it's the level of distress that I had to go through in order to learn. And I think to find the confidence. But my mom, she's the one who was constantly telling me to go with the more exciting, tasty version.
We wanted to talk about cooking and writing and stuff with your mom, which is something I really regret that I didn't do with my grandmother. But anyway, so you, during COVID, you moved home to Atlanta to work on the book, and you wrote, I wanted to write down my mom's recipes, but as I got deeper and deeper into the project, I came to the conclusion that my recipes are an evolution of her recipes. And the way I cook now is and will be forever influenced by the way she cooks. Interesting that we seem to be having the same conversation, or a nice thread, though. So your mom, Jean, is clearly a terrific cook. And we were wondering if you could give us an example of a sort of classic Jean dish, and then maybe how it's evolved in your hands.
I feel like the kimchi fried rice in the book is a good example. One thing that's great about putting out a cookbook is all these people read it and read into it and tell you back what you've done. And you're like, yeah, I did that. Yeah, that was on purpose. And
when you start forgetting that you did it, that's...
or just people make you sound way smarter than you intended. And anyway, and then, but there's a kimchi fried rice recipe. And kimchi fried rice is sort of my prodigal son meal, in addition to the Argentine empanadas. As a combo, they're great. And they're what I look forward to every Christmas. It's like my mom's thing that she makes. And also, before writing the cookbook, the first time I ever wrote about my family was this essay I wrote for Food 52. That was my first time trying that form of writing or memoir writing about family and food. And it was about coming out to my parents over, you know, that kimchi fried rice and the way it's sort of always been our centrifugal force, like the thing that is always just on the stove when I'm home, because it's really easy to cook, but it's also really easy to eat. And it's really just like, it tastes good cold and hot, and it's perfect. And it has Spam and a lot of like, you know, kim, and it's very simple. It's very sweet because of the onion and the way my mom sometimes uses butter and maybe even a pinch of sugar sometimes. Anyway, when I came to that recipe, I just like didn't want to write that one again. So I was in the kitchen trying to come up with my own version. And that's, you know how that is when you're trying to force a recipe. But what came out was really interesting. And I took all of the lessons that I learned from my mom. Like, for instance, she taught me, one of the most important things she taught me that year was blooming your gochugaru in fat. So, you know, that red pepper powder, the Korean one that you use for kimchi, gochugaru, is like so fragrant, it's so flavorful. It's not really for heat, I don't think. I use it for flavor, and so does my mom. And the way to expand the flavor is to bloom it in some fat. And so that kimchi fried rice starts with, I think it starts with butter maybe and some gochugaru, and that permeates the dish. And it's entirely vegetarian on accident. And I like it because it tastes like fire. And there's a Korean word for it, pulmat. And it's like fire taste. And that flavor comes from just the high heat. And I think that recipe kind of showcased me honoring the things that my mom does, but also trying to attempt a new version after a lifetime of her kind of essential fried rice, you know? And there's even like a cheesy essay before called Nest. And it's about like, I don't know, it's heavy handed, but because the rice has like a like a little nest of the seaweed, an egg yolk, but it actually tastes good. Like there's a reason for that. It's like a good eating experience because I love the egg yolk. That's like the best part. But, you know, I don't know. Since then, I've done like a sheet pan kimchi fried rice. I've done like other kinds of dishes. And it's fun to see the progression of your cooking. And I think it starts with my mom's cooking.
You write about, assuming I'm pronouncing it right, son mat,
yeah,
which means hand taste in English, and in a way it's signature. It's one of your signatures, and it means cooking by instinct and taste, feel. That's the opposite of how most people, or most Americans anyway, cook. Or it's certainly the opposite of way people who come to cooking as a new thing, who don't grow up with cooking, cook. But what was it about when you were learning how to cook? How did this come about?
You know, I love that word because I think it really explains well what I'm trying to get across with the recipes in this book, which is that there's this quality. It's like very unknowable quality about my mom's food that I think I didn't appreciate when I was growing up. I guess I did, but it wasn't until later I realized how special it was, which is that her food was special. But some adults can't cook. And that's something you don't know as a kid. You go over to someone's house and someone's mom tries to make you breakfast. And I don't know, when you're a kid, you're not thinking like, wow, this woman, her omelet is not as good as my mom's. But you know, as an adult, I realized that her food was special. And I think it has to do with the way you season your food. And a part of me, even before I started cooking professionally, I feel like I knew that was something that I maybe had, and it's probably something I learned from her, but this notion of people taking a bite of your food and that first look in their face, and they're like, whoa, surprise, and like, they're like surprised, or they're delighted, or they like smack their lips, or there's something to be said for like very gentle accumulating flavors that like build up over time in a dish. But I also really like, you know, when you have like one opportunity, it kind of reminds me of that show Taste. I think it was called Taste. Nigella Lawson was one of the hosts, and I forgot who the other ones were. But it was like a competition show where everyone had to cook, and your palate was just this tiny spoon, tasting spoon. And I love that idea because I feel like that's the way I think about my recipes and my reputation. And I like when that first bite is really impactful. There are recipes that can help a reader arrive at like just the standard like status quo, and like if it like works for everyone, but it can never like quite reach this for anyone. And so we're always trying to calibrate like the balance between those two things. It's like, how do you translate hand taste? It's like really hard. I don't know, like I was cooking someone's recipe recently and it didn't come out that great, but I respected the recipe because I knew that what was behind the recipe was probably years of experience and like the way that person seasons it, every little like part and the heat levels of the whatever. And so I'm really fascinated by the translation of this kind of thing, because translating hand taste is very difficult, I think. And this book was definitely the hardest thing I've ever done.
We'll be back in just a minute with more from Eric Kim.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hi, folks. We have a new sponsor and an interesting one.
We all take about 20,000 breaths a day, and Americans spend about 90% of our time indoors. That indoor air that we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. And indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So, what's the solution? Introducing Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code BITMAN, B-I-T-T-M-A-N, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to our listeners, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. That's airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code BITMAN.
I mean, recipe writing is hard because if you ever try to follow your own recipes, it's actually not all that easy.
Yeah.
And, really, what you're trying to do is teach people how to cook by some kind of example, and it takes some time. So,
yeah,
what do you assume? What do you not assume? What's people's palates like? And blah blah blah, all of that.
I love thinking about that kind of stuff because it's, not just because I do it every day, but it made me really appreciate the recipe as a document and as a cultural artifact. You know, these recipes in the book are obviously super important to me, but I also wrote them 2 or 3 years ago before I started this job. And I just feel like every year I get so much better, not just as a cook, but also as a recipe developer. And do you feel like that, Mark? Like, do you ever go back to your old recipes and think, wow, I'm way better now? Or sometimes there's that moment where you're like, wow, I overthink things today.
There's an evolution. I mean,
evolution.
You know, a recipe that's 20 years old is not a contemporary recipe. So if you wrote it 20 years ago, I mean, it's not going to happen in your case for a while. But if you look at stuff that you wrote 20 or 30 or even longer ago, you're like, yeah, I wouldn't do it that way now. That's not right. But it was right then.
Right. You know, sometimes I look at old recipes and I'm like, I think back then people knew more, so you had to explain less. And there's something... My goal for 2023 is actually to try to write like shorter recipes because I've really gone maximalist somehow over the year. And I'm really fascinated by the recipe that is very concise. And because sometimes when you over index on the information, you can overwhelm the reader. And so I don't know, it's a constant juggling act. And well, with that said, I did make your stuffing and it was very good. I liked it. It was, you know, it really inspired me to like stay minimal. And it's always a lesson that I think about. It's like, I don't know, you really need to let the ingredients shine. You know, you don't need that many things.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I think we tend to think that the more ingredients, the tastier it will be, or at least a lot of people think that way. And it just doesn't need to be the case.
Yeah, it's not true. Yeah, that's what I love learning every day. I'm testing something and I know that if I pull out a couple ingredients, everything's going to shine a little more. And it's very exciting. That kind of lesson, many people already know in their lives, but it really was expounded for me in Italy this year. I went to Bologna and had some, I don't know, just like that first meal was pasta, but I could taste the 3 or 4 ingredients and that like in-season asparagus. And I was just like, damn, this is so good. Now, how do I replicate it with like crappy asparagus from my like New York? You know, grocery store.
You don't.
Yeah, and that's fun too. Using really bad ingredients to like make something good, so that you know, I actually love shopping in my neighborhood because I know that this is like the quality that most people are used to. And I love developing recipes in my mom's at home in Atlanta in the suburbs because it's like this is what people are finding. And yeah, because sometimes you're in an echo chamber when you're in New York or Brooklyn, and it's sort of this fantastical farmer's market experience, but that's just like not real life for a lot of people.
Yeah, we try. I consciously try to do both. I mean, I do live in a fantasy land when it comes to food, but then I shop at Stop and Shop or Walmart or H-Mart sometimes or whatever.
H-Mart is my fantasy land.
It is.
My personal fantasy. Yeah, my personal fantasy land. Living near an H-Mart is just the greatest thing.
Yeah, H-Mart's one of those things where the more space they have, the cooler it gets. And so I love visiting the Jersey one, or I love going to, I just love going back home to Atlanta because you forget what's possible when there's like all that space and just the bounty of prepared foods and ingredients. And it's really wonderful. Yeah. They have this whole section in my H-Mart in my hometown where they pop rice for like these huge like rice cakes. And I'm just like, who the hell is buying this?
Wow.
Why is this stand here? It's like takes up so much real estate, but it takes up a whole quarter of the grocery store. But the grocery store is huge. And then there's this lady selling her own doenjang, I think. And I'm like, is this foods grade? Like, or is this like, you know, USDA or whatever, legally? I don't know. Probably isn't, but like delicious. I'm sure.
Yeah. Focus on the latter.
Yeah, it's cool. I don't know. I like the what space can afford you. And it makes me cynical about my New York apartment, which this is as big as it gets. Sometimes I worry that this apartment is more of a studio for work than living. And so I don't know. I compensate by just like leaving the house once in a while. And
Mark has had some very small New York City kitchens too.
I also did the minimalist living in a basement for 6 months or so. Did the minimalist on a hot plate, a microwave. And then I'd go to friends' houses and borrow their kitchens in emergencies.
Nice.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Man, those memories are the best, though. Like, I cooked for my team when I worked at Food Network. It was like an editorial team of 8 or 10, and they all came over to my 250 square foot studio apartment. Really, really crappy place, but I had decorated it, so it was pretty cute, I guess. And I had no gas, so I made a pot of risotto on a hot plate, and I roasted vegetables in a toaster oven, and somehow did this like procession of courses because I used to entertain like that back then. And now I'm just like, now I don't cook like that, even though I have a little more space. But I don't know. I'll think fondly on this kitchen once I move out of this place. an upgrade. But right now, it's like, I don't know. I like it. I like it a lot. It's efficient. It's really efficient.
I know you're probably really tired of talking about kimchi at this point, but I have to ask you one question. Can you tell me about a traditional kimjang? Because I had never heard about it, and it almost sounds like a kimchi festival.
Yeah, isn't that cool? I think festival is a great word. I think there are actually festivals all over the world, but you know, I think the way I describe it is it's more of an act. It's like an act of making kimchi. And I think traditionally it was with the villages, or it was with your whole town or your whole, maybe just your family now. But, you know, my mom and I talk about our solo kimjangs all the time. I love kimjangs. It's kind of like making bread, very similar in the way that it takes a long time and you have to be around, but not that around. And then you can like take a bath or drink wine and it's very... It can be very therapeutic if you like podcasts like I do. I love true crime podcasts. So I'm always listening to something while making kimchi. And what's really lovely about, man, I really wrote about kimchi this year. Like I really went for it many, many times. And it was so rewarding to, it's kind of like that kimchi fried rice recipe. It felt like a graduation or something from Korean cuisine. I was like, not that I'm, you know, I have a lot more to learn, of course, but kimchi was something that I wanted to get better at because my mom's is so good. And mine's very different, but I've arrived at my own kind of way of doing it. And now I make one with kale, and I love adding a little beetroot because that's what my mom does. And I don't know, I cut a lot of corners. I think if you want to do the right way, you should follow Mangchi's recipes or my mom's recipe in the book. But, you know, I was trying to figure out how to fit it into my daily life. And so that involves, instead of like huge basins of water, which would be catastrophic in this kitchen, I found that you can just use a sheet pan. And I don't know, that like works for me. And you can lay out the heads of cabbage. And yeah, I don't know. Another thing about reporting that story, I wrote a cover story for the food section about kimchi and kimjang. And I just love knowing that UNESCO had designated it a cultural heritage, an intangible cultural heritage. Just such a like epic term that no one knows.
I'm just looking at that page. The representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity.
Isn't it so?
So cool.
I think it's pretty cool and very like, I don't know, it's for like a food nerd, but I think, or a culture nerd, because what it's really saying is that there's some information that's so valuable that you need to write it down. And I feel like kimchi is like that, because a lot of modern cooks don't make their own kimchi, understandably. My hope is that people start to like recognize that making it yourself is really satisfying, because it's my way of clearing out my CRISPR drawer, to be honest. You know, it's how I think about the life cycle of a vegetable. It doesn't have to die in your CRISPR drawer. It can become a zombie vegetable, which is what I like to call kimchi. It's what Chef Chie Kim said for my story. Yeah, she's in Michigan, really talented cook. But yeah, the fact that it's intangible, that's like the main, I think, the important keyword. It's saying that it's not a monument, it's not a building, it's in living people's brains, and those people are gonna, you know, people die. So you have to write it down before it's too late. I like that idea. I think that was the thesis of this book really as well. Write down your family recipes before it's too late. And I think when I say that people who have lost their parents sometimes feel that it leaves them out of the equation, but I also like to always add that when you're trying to write down a family recipe, sometimes it's not even really the actual recipe, as we know that, especially moms and grandmas, and they're not very good at like explaining their own recipes because they just do it. But I think what's really important is the taste memory, and following your taste memory, as long as you remember what it tastes like, and you do need a certain level of skill in the kitchen, I guess, but I think that's what you're really chasing. And when my mother and I were cooking this book, we were really chasing the memory mostly, like the platonic ideal of that dish, whatever it was. And so I thought that was more, I think it's not just as simple as like writing down the recipe. It's, does it match the memory of it? And usually the memory is clouded with rose tinted glasses. And I think that's okay. Yeah.
Like the way your kitchen will be after you leave it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, good.
When I was with the Times in the 90s, before the minimalist started, I went to found some Korean chef to teach me how to make kimchi in Midtown. And I went and did a kimchi story. It'd be interesting to look at that and see how bad it is or not. But
that's good. I'll check it out.
I remember the guy put, you know, there was dried shrimp, but I think he used fresh oysters too. There was a lot of stuff in there. It was really good kimchi. And then I was on a kimchi kick for a few years, and then I sort of moved on. But yeah. You're making me want to make it. I love the idea of using nearly dead greens to make kimchi.
Yeah, that bitterness is lovely. It also permeates the rest of the kimchi. Like, you'll have a bite of the cabbage and taste the bitterness of the Tuscan kale. And I don't know. My favorite kimchis are the bitter greens.
Last question. We ask everyone this, which is, what'd you have for dinner last night?
Oh, I mean, actually, speaking of which, man, I made the best kimchi jjigae. It tastes more like a kimchi soup or like a kimchi kook. So it's a little brothier, so vibrant and bright, because I use like really old kimchi that I've been trying to get rid of, to be honest. But before I made it, because I had no meat or anything, which usually imbues the stew with, you know, flavor, I sauteed in some oil and a little butter. I sauteed all this like cilantro I had, stems and all. And I also did all the scallions. I was like, I'm clearing out my fridge because I'm trying to go home for Christmas. And man, it was so good. It ended up tasting like tom yum soup, which was really appropriate because I was also working on a pineapple fried rice recipe, which is going to come out in the magazine soon. And that recipe, you know, the rice with the coconutty flavor, and then the stew next to it. That's what I had. It's very delicious.
Sounds great.
This might be my favorite answer to this question that we've had so far.
It's pretty good, especially from a guy who just said, I love junk food. And then he's like, yeah, cooked everything in the fridge. I do the cook everything in the fridge thing all the time too. Yeah.
It's satisfying.
I bet everybody who has a lot of ingredients around does that.
It doesn't always work, though. Sometimes you make something awful.
Yeah. Sometimes you wind up throwing the stuff out anyway. But yeah.
Yeah. So this was good.
Thanks a million, Eric. Yeah,
thank you, Eric.
Have a good day, guys.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
The recipe we're giving you from Eric's book today is a sheet pan bibimbap. Many of you know that bibimbap is roasted or baked, anyway, cooked rice with vegetables or vegetables and meat or whatever. There are many different ways to do bibimbap, but I never thought of cooking bibimbap on a sheet pan. Eric actually uses two, and so this is a creative and interesting recipe, sheet pan bibimbap with roasted fall vegetables. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. I'll read you the ingredients first. You need two sheet pans and a pound of butternut squash, seeded and cut into bite-sized pieces. That's about 4 cups. You don't need to peel it. Olive oil, salt, and pepper as needed. 10 ounces of wild mushrooms, especially shiitake and oyster, torn into bite-sized pieces. That'd be about 3 cups. A medium red onion, halved and thinly sliced. A large red apple, halved, cored, and cut into bite-sized pieces. 4 ounces Tuscan kale, lacinato kale, chopped into 1-inch pieces. That should be about 4 cups. 4 cups of freshly cooked white rice. That would be short grain. 2 teaspoons of toasted sesame oil, 4 teaspoons gochujang, that's Korean chili paste, and 4 large raw egg yolks. Eric says, ones you feel confident about. I like that. So preheat the oven to 450, and on 1 sheet pan, toss the butternut squash with 2 tablespoons of olive oil, some salt and pepper. Move that to 1/2 of the pan and add the mushrooms and the onion to the other half of the pan. Toss them with 2 tablespoons of olive oil and some salt and pepper. And bake that at 450 degrees, as I think I said, until the butternut squash and the mushroom onion mixture are crisp and burnished about 45 minutes. You might want to stir that now and then. Meanwhile, on another sheet pan, arrange the apples and the kale separately, 1 on each half of the pan. Toss each with 1 tablespoon of olive oil and some salt and pepper and set that aside. Once the squash and the mushrooms have had their time, 45 minutes or so, take them out of the oven and toss them with a silicone spatula. Return the pan to the oven along with the second pan with the apples and kale. And bake until the kale is wilted slightly and become crisp, and the apple slices are slightly softened, and the squash, onion, and mushrooms are even more caramelized, another 15 minutes or so. Divide the rice evenly among 4 large bowls, and to each bowl add 1 teaspoon of gochujang and 1/2 teaspoon of sesame oil. Then divide the roasted vegetables and apple evenly among the 4 bowls, keeping them in color-blocked sections. Finish each bowl with a single egg yolk. To eat, you just mix everything together and dig in. That is modern bibimbap, sheet pan bibimbap. Enjoy that. I mean, so interesting. So much fun, as you can tell. And we're going to do more like that, and we hope to have Eric back because we thought he was a terrific guest. So thank you, Eric, for coming on. You can follow Eric on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Eric June Ho. That's ericjoonho. His book, Korean American, is out now. Thanks to Kate for joining me and for producing the show. And as usual, to our engineer, Davis Lloyd. We hope to see you next week when we will have somebody awesome. Bye for now.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.